This episode is brought to you by LifeLock. So much of your personal info is out of your control, like your insurance provider that has your social security number and your favorite retailer that has your payment details. If they get breached, your information, your identity, is vulnerable. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points a second for threats. If your identity is stolen, they'll fix it, guaranteed or your money back. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/podcast. Terms apply.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. We're going to be talking to Congressman Jim Banks in about 30 minutes, and we have other surprise guests. 1-866-408-7669. We have a lot on the agenda today. So does both campaigns. Donald Trump will speak at the National Faith Advisory Board over in Powder Springs, Georgia. And then I think he's going to make some remarks at a rally. Harris is, and Walz will have a joint campaign rally, bring back the magic in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Vance is going to be in Wisconsin, Racine and Wausau. So they are really sprinting to the end because we are now 8 days away. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
We conducted targeted and precise strikes on military targets in Iran.
The IDF said it hit Iranian surface-to-air missile systems and missile production sites.
That is the IDF spokesperson through CBS talking about Israel and their surgical strikes back at Iran. And once again, Biden pushes to scale back the response to Iran's 180 missile barrage 3 weeks ago. Hostage talks are back for the first time in months, and this will play a big role in the election.
Number two.
Can someone tell me why we are once again holding Kamala to a higher standard than her opponent? Too many people are willing to write off his childish, mean-spirited antics by saying, well, Trump's just being Trump.
Yeah, what a mean-spirited speech Michelle Obama has. Just filled with venom. 2024, Harris rolls out a series of surrogates and a message of fear. Fear of a Trump win. Will this closing tactic work? We'll find out tomorrow in her closing speech. We go inside the numbers today.
Number one.
But this is the city where I was born and raised, and this is the town that taught me that Americans can do anything when they want to. So no matter our differences, when we work together, there is nothing that we cannot achieve.
Trump takes Manhattan as he rallies a raucous crowd at the world's most famous arena. We look at the most unique speaker list in political history, perhaps. I mean, you got RFK, you got Dana White, you got Hulk Hogan, you got Tucker Carlson, you have Tulsi Gabbard. I mean, you got to be kidding me. And then introducing the president, something traditional. The former president, the former first lady, both could be the next. We could be president-elect and first lady-elect, which was a surprise. Found out that was a surprise even to him. Up until the last minute, they weren't sure that Melania was going to come. She's shy. She doesn't love the press. She gets a lot of bad. She has a lot of bad blowback when she speaks for most of it unnecessary reasons. And she doesn't love it. But yesterday I thought was extraordinary. Why? How about this? In New York City, thousands arrived as early as 6 in the morning. How do I know? Carly Shimkus, our fine reporter for Fox and Friends, up at 6 to work the crowd and to see since thousands of people were there. New Jersey, Connecticut, New York City, they were all there. The other thing that I thought was heartening, it's good for the country as well as, but there was no protests. There was no, oh, you're wearing a red hat. I think I'll punch you in the face. Oh, you like Trump. How dare you? Let me spit on your shoes. None of that. I've talked to so many people. No negativity. The places was flooded with people, and they way oversold or reservations, or people just wanted to be a part of it and see him for the last time. Now, I don't know what everyone else could be thinking. For example, you go ahead and you tell everyone how bad Trump is, that he colluded with Russia, that he cheats on his taxes, that he has all these personal things that need to be looked at civilly. And then criminally, and he gets 5 different indictments, and he gets 1 conviction, 34 counts, and then he gets the nomination. But he's a terrible person. Remember January 6th? Remember all that? Yes. And he got impeached, right? And then he gets the nomination. And then he's winning so much in the debate over Joe Biden, they get rid of Joe Biden. They bring in Harris. She surged ahead. Now she surged back. And now take a look at the polls. I mean, right now, as it stands, look at these trends and think about what it was at in 2016 and 2020 nationally, which Republicans aren't expected to win the national polls. Right now, Wall Street Journal has it 49-46. New York Times, 48-48. CNN, 47-47. ABC, the only one that has Harris up by three. And then CNBC has Trump up by two. So far, impressions of the candidates, positive. Harris has dropped 7 points. She's at now 42%. By the way, President Biden at 39%. Persuadables, estimates, 12% said they could change their mind, according to CNBC poll, and 6% undecided or a vote for a third party. So that makes both campaigns who want to be sure to go ahead and target people that low propensity voters or ones that are undecided. You got to go out and find them in the battleground states right now. On average, according to the 538, Michigan 0.4 for Harris, Wisconsin 0.1 for Harris. According to the Trump team, they think they're weakest in Wisconsin out of the battlegrounds. Nevada, Trump up by 0.3. Pennsylvania, Trump up by 0.4. North Carolina, Trump up 1.4. Georgia, Trump up 1.6. Arizona, Trump up to 2.0. Guys, this is significant. And what I think is also significant is Trump's trying to win it by himself. You know what she's doing? She's got Barack Obama. She's got Beyonce. She's got Willie Nelson. She's got Robert De Niro, Leo DiCaprio, Oprah. I mean, what is going on? Now today, Taylor Swift, the most famous people in the world, and she's not winning. I'm not saying she can't win, but she's not winning. That, to me, is significant. Also, Norah O'Donnell, they released a clip. When it comes down to, okay, you're for restoring reproductive rights. Okay, for what does that mean? Well, I want to restore Roe v. Wade. Well, with Roe v. Wade, there are restrictions. Do you have restrictions, Norah O'Donnell asked. And she says, Donald Trump is causing women to die. Doesn't answer the question. Everything when in doubt, Donald Trump. So here's a little of Trump last night. Cut one.
But this is the city where I was born and raised, and this is the town that taught me that Americans can do anything when they want to. So no matter our differences, when we work together, there is nothing that we cannot achieve.
Right. Optimistic. So I talked to someone over the weekend, say, you know, what is the message? Yeah. America's broke, but we can fix it. This is where we're at, but it's going to get better. It's going to gradually get more and more positive. And that's what I heard last night. I'm curious to see what you think. 1-866-408-7669. Here's more from Trump. Cut two. The stuff he'll do.
And I'm announcing a new policy today that I will support a tax credit for family caregivers who take care of a parent or a loved one. It's about time that they were recognized, right? They add so much to our country and are never spoken of, ever, 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 but they're going to be spoken of now. Thank you all very much.
Right. And the thing is, there was a comedian that got on 3 hours before Trump. I don't even want to bring him up. I remember watching, I flipped over to the Newsmax with CNBC, somebody, or C-SPAN, somebody was streaming it because we didn't have it on our channel yet, I don't think. And I don't know who this guy is, but he's got a podcast. And he made some off-color remarks. And by the way, the stuff that wasn't off-color wasn't funny. But, you know, I'm sure people thought he was funny. Whoever booked him on the roster made a huge mistake. He put down the people of Puerto Rico, said it's a garbage, it's an island full of garbage or something to that effect. And Rick Scott, Anthony D'Esposito, the congressman from New York, Rick Scott, the senator from Florida, Republicans, and the Trump campaign say, listen, I don't know who the hell said that or who the hell booked him, but that has nothing to do with us. But that is the headline. Let's go look at this headline in the New York Times. A closing argument of grievance, misogyny, and racism. If you watched that yesterday and were independent and not a Trump hater, you would not think this is a time of grievance. Pointing out with your opponent's done bad and why President Trump would be the right choice. That's what I pulled from it. Crowd was huge right in New York City. That's why Trump, every time he appears, he says, what do you mean I'm losing New York? Now, keep in mind, Lee Zeldin only lost the governor's race by 4 points. The other thing I find really curious is how positive he's being with Mayor Adams. Look, I know it's just a mayor, and you have your own mayors around the country, but Mayor Adams is a little different. It's New York City is the number one city in terms of population, things to do, diversity and fame. So when he takes over for this lazy de Blasio guy, he tries to overturn no cash bail. He tries to say, I have a crime problem. I'm going to try to fix it, even though I don't think he should have done. He could have done more things. He never should have. He should have empowered his police chief to do more work. He got involved. There were some things along the way that made him seem like a Democrat. But then when people, thousands started coming here illegally, 100, 200,000, 70,000 still here, he told said the federal government is letting us down. And since that time, his legal team has been working overtime, and he couldn't stop five indictments from coming his direction. So I think that is noteworthy that he, the president, says, look, as soon as you came out against this administration, Mayor Adams, that's when all of a sudden you have these legal problems. And that's what Trump said. As soon as Trump started running, then he had all those issues. Then he had all the issues with the taxes, with the civil suits, from something that this woman claimed happened 30 years ago, but she doesn't know the date and is not positive of the year. But here are some of the things that took place yesterday. These are the types of people that are everyman people. I mean, you have RFK, Democrat, famous Democrat family, said Donald Trump came up to me and said, we're going to disagree on a lot, but we agree on a lot more. Why don't you come aboard? He's going to handle health. And then Elon Musk and Trump were never that tight. But suddenly he came on board with Trump. He says, I don't like what's happening in this country. I'm still being sued. I'm being held back with my myriad of companies, including SpaceX, Starlink. Now he's putting chips in brains. Now he's got Tesla. And he feels as though he's getting a hard time with his super regulation. And it all started when he bought Twitter. And when he exposed the Twitter files, how government was in collusion with these big social media companies to suppress certain stories and suppress certain people. And then you get this eclectic view of people. They weren't talking about Republicans. They were talking about common sense. Here's Dana White, one of the most successful business people in the country, globally. Cut 14.
We are 9 days away from the most important election of my lifetime. Stakes have never been higher, and the choice has never been clearer. He's proven to be the strong leader allies and adversaries alike must respect. He's proven he loves this country so much, he's literally put his life on the line for it.
And they've been buddies forever. And when he was asked to speak at the RNC, he said, I'm sorry, I'm away on my cruise. And he ended up getting a helicopter to land on the cruise ship, take him off, and then bring him back right after the speech. That's how much the friendship means. He doesn't need it to be famous. He doesn't need it for influence. He says, I never asked Trump for a thing. Trump maybe just asked for a ringside seat, has dramatic entrances, and the fighters seem to love him. That's an eclectic group. The one that stood out to me is Elon Musk. So Elon Musk is a bit of a different of a guy, maybe the smartest man on the planet, certainly the most productive, insightful, gets a hard time from a lot of people. Doesn't seem to really care. And it's amazing for a guy that's probably known around the world and has done so many remarkable things. When they started chanting his name, he looked moved. So here's a little of what Elon Musk, the modern day Henry Ford, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Edison. Cut 18.
Vote early. This is important. We're going to be putting up a scorecard, okay? An early vote scorecard, state by state, county by county. What is the scorecard? Vote early. Vote now. Make the margin of victory so big that you know what can happen. Massive, overwhelming sweep of every swing state and even some of the states that aren't, people don't think are swing states. Massive, crushing victory. Get everyone, friends, family, people on the street. Put the signs up. Put the hat on.
And he had that dark MAGA hat. Evidently, he became the bestseller, all black with black lettering. So, look, I could play some of these cuts all night. I'm sure some of you missed it because you're watching football or you're just on Sunday nights. You can't see it. It's supposed to start at 5, ends up starting an hour and a half or 2 hours later. But a lot of the preliminaries were in and out with John Scott kind of riding it out here. I got Hulk Hogan and some more. And, of course, Melania's surprise introduction. And then on Saturday, the Friday interview was dropped for Joe Rogan on the podcast. Lasted 3 hours. And that, to me, was Donald Trump trying to get on there. Joe Rogan said, I've seen enough, come on. And I'll just give you a clip of that, too. So we have a lot to say. This thing is not over. And one thing is pretty clear. What is over is people taking their cues from CNN or MSNBC and telling them who, how to vote, who's bad and who's good. No one's paying attention. They're about to find this out. Don't move.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
Precise, personal, powerful. It's America's weather team in the palm of your hands. Get Fox weather updates throughout your busy day, every day. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Right now, this race looks as close as it actually was in 2016 and 2020, which is to say, it is basically a toss-up. And if you look at the 538 battleground state polling, you see some momentum for Trump in some of the key battlegrounds, but all of these numbers within a point or 2 points, well within polling margins of error, and it means we truly don't know who's going to win on election night.
So that's ABC's Rick Klein. He had numbers in front of him, but it's not even worth going over. Just know they're neck and neck. What people should understand, too, is no one's calling thinking this is won yet, but the momentum is absolutely with Trump. Jonathan Martin, Cut 31, Meet the Press.
They're resonating with their base, and there's about three voters left undecided that are going to decide the fate of the world. I think both candidates are taking risks in the final 2 weeks of the election. We'll start with Kamala Harris. I think she's taking a risk by making this about January 6th and democracy so heavily, because so many of the people who are animated by those issues are already in her column. I'll be curious to see the speech on Tuesday. How much does she pivot to how she would govern and if she governed from the center?
So Jonathan Martin's 100% right, and it doesn't make any sense. Who's telling her this whole threat to democracy, which wasn't working for Joe Biden before he imploded? But, you know, stats are stats. When you watch the best speaker or worst speaker, you just say, I can just tell what was your best moment, not who's the best speaker. What was your best moment during that speech? Personally, I haven't seen stats, but Barack Obama calling out black people, black males for not voting for women because they don't like women. To me, that had to be one of the worst tactical moves ever, no matter how eloquent and defiant you look when you say it. And then when she's going to sit there and say January 6th, here's Liz Cheney, January 6th, I remember how bad the Capitol was, January 6th, Donald Trump stood here. And if she isn't going to talk about January 6th, why are you picking that spot? You just talk about how you're going to govern, and you should have pre-thought what's the difference between you and Joe Biden. That would certainly be a difference. But that's what the experts are saying, how close this is. Cut 32.
I think Trump's also risking because, Kristen, he is traveling all over the country. It's not just the Garden tonight in New York City. I'm now told he's going to New Mexico. Mm. New Mexico in the final week of the election. He's also, we know, going to Virginia. And there's talk he even may go to New Hampshire. Guys, those are all blue states and have been for multiple cycles in a row. So he's taking a risk, I think, by leaving the three battleground states, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, which most folks think are going to decide the election.
Yeah. I think he's looking at a little of the undercard, the congressmen, the senators there. I think that's part of it. Also, there's a sense that they have a shot in New Mexico. I know that for sure. And in talking to Chris Sununu, the governor there, he thinks that the Trump is much closer than the camp thought. He said they pulled a lot of their apparatus out, and I don't know why. They also want to make sure the governor stays Republican there. So there's other reasons. I don't think they're into the money mode. And Kamala Harris has enough money, too.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Madam Vice President, can you give us a sense of your internal polling at the campaign and how that is making or influencing your decisions on what to do over the next 9 days?
So, to be very frank with you, my internal polling is my instinct. I let the campaign people deal with all that other stuff.
Well, I'm not buying that at all. In fact, I got the reports earlier that she does not like being out there. She wants to strategize. She likes going to meetings and strategizing. So I'm pretty sure everything about her is scripted, but it's an interesting approach to say that. Congressman Jim Banks joins us now, Armed Services Education and members of the House Select Committee on strategic competition between the U.S. and China, which was making great progress when Congressman Gallagher was there. I don't really know what's been happening lately. Congressman, welcome back. Your thought about where the House stands now. You know, Fox has about 30 seats in contention. Where do you guys have it at?
Well, you know, it looks good. It looks good for President Trump. And when President Trump wins in these swing districts and these swing states, he brings out voters who don't vote otherwise. And that's why I'm optimistic, not just about growing the House majority, but winning the Senate majority and firing Chuck Schumer from the leader's position in the Senate. That's what I'm focused on, running for the Senate in Indiana, and Donald Trump winning big. So the bigger Donald Trump wins on election night, the bigger our House majority is going to be. And Brian, remember that both in 2016 and 2020, both times that Donald Trump has been on the ballot, we picked up House seats. That's the fact of the matter. He's the secret weapon that we have as Republicans to bring out voters and win the tough districts and the tough states. And I'm expecting a big election night a week from tomorrow.
So what is your take on Vice President Mike Pence's decision just to sit it out and not endorse President Trump? Do you think this is related to January 6th? Because I thought they got over it. Next thing you know, we bowed out of it. Then people say it's because President Trump's not pro-life enough. Then we watched him on the stage try to get the nomination. I know he's a friend of yours. What's going on there?
Well, it's disappointing. I've known Mike Pence for many years. I served in the State House when he was governor, really looked up to him when he was a conservative in the House of Representatives. And for all of 4 years, he was a great vice president to Donald Trump. But it's disappointing. And Hoosiers are disappointed in it because it shows, I think, disloyalty to the man who made him the vice president. And the night and day difference between the values of Donald Trump and the America First agenda, the conservative values that Donald Trump fought for 4 years, and what Kamala Harris brings to the table, it's a night and day difference. There's no daylight between these two, between a president who loves America, who puts America first, and Kamala Harris, who we know will put America last. If she's elected, God forbid, she would be the most pro-abortion, anti-America president that we've ever had in American history. So There's still a week to go for Mike Pence to change his mind and let the country know that it's time to put personalities aside and do the right thing and endorse Donald Trump. And I hope he'll do that.
Are you going to call him?
He knows where I stand. I've been in touch with. I think he gets bad advice from some members of his team. I can't fully explain why he's made the decision that he has, but he knows that many of us are disappointed in him for it.
I, you know what, we usually reach out, and I usually get a call back. If they can't do it, they always express apologies. As soon as we made the request, they said, we're not doing anything. I thought, wow, do you want to ask him first? So I thought it was bizarre. We'll see. Governor Tim Walz, who I know you know well, and you're going to talk about that in a second, he was busy over the weekend, having no problem comparing the MSG rally to a Nazi fest. Cut 12.
Donald Trump's got this big rally going at Madison Square Garden. There's a direct parallel to a big rally that happened in the mid-1930s at Madison Square Garden. And don't think that he doesn't know for 1 second exactly what they're doing there. So look, we said we're all running like everything's on the line because it is.
And before you even answer, Congressman Banks, keep in mind, Eisenhower had a rally there. FDR had a rally there. Truman had a rally there. Nixon had a rally there. Reagan had a rally there. The Madison Square Garden is a common place for politicians to want to go. Their nickname is the world's most famous arena. That, to me, is just a nutty storyline.
Yeah. More of the same from Tim Walz and Kamala Harris. I mean, at this point, Brian, they're desperate. They have nothing else to do here but call Republicans racist and Hitler and all of these things that the American people are so tired of that. But that's all Kamala Harris has left in her is these desperate name calling moves. And I get the sense that the American people are sick of it. They see through it, and Donald Trump's going to win by even a larger margin next Tuesday because of it.
All right, so let's talk about this. You were demanding an investigation to be opened up into a Minnesota professor who was appointed to a working group examining ethics studies within Governor Walz's Department of Education. Could you expand on what's bothering you about this?
Yeah. Brian, I've been saying this for a few years, that the biggest difference between Republicans and Democrats today isn't what it used to be. It's that we believe as Republicans that America is great, the greatest country in the history of the world. And the Democrats, they don't. They believe America is inherently racist and evil, and they want to tear it down. And Tim Walz proves that. As governor, he put this Leszczynski guy in charge of in a position of influence over curriculum and the education of kids in Minnesota. And he's a renowned critical race theorist who actually said that America should be deconstructed, it should be destroyed. And that's the key tenet of critical race theory. If those are the views that one of the most important people that Tim Walz picked in a position of influence in the education of kids in Minnesota, imagine what Kamala Harris and Tim Walz would do if they were in the White House, the type of propaganda and ideology they would push on our kids all over the country. So I've asked the Inspector General, the Department of Education in Minnesota, to explain why they have someone who's so radically anti-America in a position of authority. And keep in mind as well that 60% of the funding of the Minnesota Department of Education comes from the federal government. So there's a link here between what I do as a member of Congress and the budgets that we pass for the federal Department of Education. All those dollars go into an anti-America State Department of Education in Minnesota. And keep in mind, too, that this is the same Governor Walz who oversaw the destruction of the city of Minneapolis, who supported BLM, the BLM riots, refused the National Guard help from the mayor of Minneapolis, who asked for help for 3 days because he supported that dangerous anti-police radicalism that destroyed the city of burned down Minneapolis too. So there are a lot of dangerous views by Tim Walz, and I don't want to make it about him. I want to make it about Kamala Harris, because she picked this guy to be her running mate, and that's the type of judgment, the bad judgment that she's already proven that we can't allow to go anywhere near the White House.
I mean, it was her first big decision, and I can't imagine they don't regret it. I mean, you have Mark Kelly, who's an astronaut, Air Force pilot, military grad. So just because he's not charismatic, I mean, you have a lot more positives than Governor Tim Walz, a linebacker's coach from high school. So it's just nuts that they made this choice. But there's something else that you're also, yes, mate, they haven't showed their regrets. Maybe they are happy with it, but it's just bizarre. You sent a letter that calls on Jennifer Hoppenstedt, an interim inspector general of the Minnesota Department of Education, to investigate Brian Leszczynski, an associate professor of urban and multicultural education at McAllister College, over comments calling for the insurrection against the United States. This is the call. Cut 29.
We don't use critical race theory in school. The first tenet of critical race theory is that the United States as constructed is irreversibly racist. So if the nation state as constructed is irreversibly racist, then it must be done with. It must be overthrown, right? And so we can't be like, oh, no, critical race theory is just about telling our stories and diverse. It's not about that. It's about overthrow. It's insurgent. We need to be, I think, more honest with that. And it's funny that they don't understand critical race theory, but they actually tell some truth when they're like, yeah, it is anti-state. You can't be a critical race theorist and be pro-U.S.
Yeah, I mean, that's an incendiary statement, but I wish I could say I never heard stuff like that before. I heard that a lot in 2022 and a lot in 2020. Your thoughts?
Yeah, this guy is calling for the insurrection against the United States of America, and Tim Walz put him in a position in charge of curriculum and education of kids in Minnesota. I'm calling on the Inspector General of Minnesota to investigate this guy. I mean, the views that he espouses are dangerous in and of themselves, but for him to be in a position to shape the curriculum and the education of kids in Minnesota, and then the federal government is paying for it through federal dollars flowing to the State Department of Education. There's a lot at stake here, but again, this goes back to the judgment not just of Governor Walz, but of Kamala Harris, who picked this guy to be her running mate. Very dangerous. It's unbelievable.
It really is. Congressman, if you're a senator, what do you hope it allows you to do that you're not able to do in the House?
Well, in the United States Senate, we'll have even more power to go after dangerous ideologies like this and save our kids from being taught this type of propaganda. That's my mission. I've got three daughters in public schools, and this stuff matters deeply to me. This is the greatest country in the history of the world, and we shouldn't be teaching our kids anything but that.
Right. And, Congressman, the other thing to keep in mind, you guys will probably get the majority, and nobody's talking about blowing up the filibuster. You'll get the majority. Nobody's talking about packing the court with more conservatives. No one's talking about just jamming down the throats of two more states of the American people. You just – nobody. You know, President Trump gets upset sometimes, says get rid of the filibuster. But the no doubt about it, if Senator Schumer keeps the majority, that's what they're doing if Kamala Harris wins.
Yeah, they've told us that. They say it every day. They say that's what this election is all about. And if they keep the majority in the Senate, they'll do away with the filibuster, and they'll move down this dangerous path of stuff in the stacking the Supreme Court and going back to many of the dangerous left-wing policies of the past. We can't let them do it, and that's the mission that we have over the next week. There's a lot at stake.
I hear you. Congressman Jim Banks, thanks so much. Best of luck in your Senate run.
Have a good day.
You got it. 1-866-408-7669. I do want to touch on what Israel did over the weekend and what they didn't do and what could be next, because that could also affect the election. And, of course, world peace is always on everybody's mind. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hear the ins and outs of the 2024 election right here. The Brian Kilmeade Show. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
This was Israel's largest attack on Iran ever. But we're hearing today from the Revolutionary Guard telling Israel that there's going to be severe consequences. Today, Iran's foreign ministry said that there's going to be a response because it has the right to defend itself.
So over the weekend, there was 100 aircraft hit 20 sites over in Iran. And most of those sites, so we understand it, obviously, no, we don't really have good people on the ground in Iran, obviously. But they hit mostly air defense. And what they're doing is, you remember Rocky Marciano when he used to fight much bigger guys, and he used to spend his time in the early rounds punching them in the arms. And they're like, why are you punching him in the arm? Hit him in the head. Hit him in the body. You know why? By the fifth and sixth round, they couldn't lift their arms. This is my analogy. I haven't read this anywhere, so it might not fly. What they're doing is they took out the air defenses in Syria. Now they bomb at leisure. And now they took out the air defense, most of the air defense over those two strikes in Iran. They know exactly where it is. They also tapped where Grand Ayatollah was located to let him know, we know where you are. So they hit the first time. We let him right around where the nuclear sites are to let him know, we know it's there. And now this time they blow up the S-300 Russian missile defense systems. Here's my worry, though. The Russians in Iran are so tight right now, the Russians will rush in with more missile defense quickly because they've given them so many drones and helped them out when they needed them most. Also, the Russians are all over this. The Russians feeding the Iranians and the Houthi rebels. They're providing logistics for the ships that were coming through the Red Sea to help stop shipping around the Red Sea, let alone bring in the North Koreans into Russia to fight against Ukraine. It is nuts. Here's more from Alex Hogan. I sat down with her today on Fox and Friends. As you know, she's our foreign correspondent, usually stationed in Israel and Ukraine, and was just talking to us about what this means. Cut 44.
What's going to be interesting to look at is when exactly that would play out. So there's two events that we need to look at. On April 1st, that's when Iran says that Israel destroyed its embassy in Syria, killing 7 members of the Revolutionary Guard. Iran then triggered this response. It had about 300 missiles and drones that were fired at Israel. And that was 2 weeks later after that attack. Flash forward to July when, as you mentioned, Ismail Haniyeh, the political leader of Hamas, was killed in Iran. When that happened, Iran said there was going to be a very, very strong response. Flash forward, that happened on October 1st, so about 2 months later. And that gives us a little bit of an indication that despite the fact that today we're seeing a lot of condemnation and criticism over what Israel did over the weekend, that this could be drawn out much longer.
And what I think they did is Israel worked at a quid pro quo and said that THAAD missile system, high-range system for those more potent intercontinental missiles or from multiple locations, can we got him? And the U.S., Joe Biden said yes. That was such a quick yes that I think that the deal was just make sure that retribution for the 180 rockets that went your way last month is targeted, not on oil. We don't need the oil to go up before the election, not on nuclear sites, because number one, you're going to need our help for that. And it's going to cause a lot of controversy because it could spread some type of radiation. Should you, contamination, should you be very successful, because they don't know details about it. Other news, the head of Mossad, David Barnea, and CIA director Bill Burns are in Qatar meeting with Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin something unpronounceable. This royal family head in Doha, they're trying to come up with some type of interim hostage deal. One as small as four hostages out, four prisoners out, or eight prisoners out for a two-day ceasefire, just to get something going. Because, you know, Joe Biden goes in there and goes, I want all the time to give them all out. We're going to stop the war, but we'll do this. And everyone just says, I'm not doing that. And then Sinwar, who was the hard ass through this whole thing, is dead, thankfully. But his brother, I thought was dead, looks like he survived. But what we do know is this. Sinwar and some of the what he had on him was a missive to his fellow terrorists. Keep the hostages safe. They're the only things keeping us alive. Ironically, he was dead. It was on his dead body that they found it. Now, some blowback for Bibi Netanyahu. His right, hardline right national security advisor, for example, said the Israeli strikes were just an opening blow that was not good enough. Ben Gavur also criticized Israel's response to the hit, saying the strike of an anti-craft battery is just too feeble. So he is getting some pushback. Centrist Yahya Lapid, the leader of Israel's parliamentary opposition, criticized Netanyahu's government for ultimately deciding on targets that align with Washington's requests. So they got their internal issues, too. I think you do have to go a little with Washington's request, but I would never, because of the election, if it wasn't for the election, what he has to do, Netanyahu's got to be smart. If Harris wins, and he doesn't want that, but if Harris wins, if he totally alienates Biden, she'll have a reason in backing of her party to go against him. Now, if Trump wins, it's not going to be an issue. Trump say, get it done. Brian Kilmeade Show.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade coming to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, blocks away from one of the biggest events in election that I can remember in modern history, because you have a president showing up in the middle of a blue state in the most famous city in the world, known more for not liking him, trying to sue him and put him in jail. Not originally. He used to host The Apprentice here right in his building, but then pulling off just a huge event last night. And the one thing I've been asking people is, what about the protests? Were there protesters against Trump? Because there always a protest. I mean, remember the idiot mayor, former mayor, had Black Lives Matter spray painted in the middle of the road and organized a protest behind barriers in the middle of the pandemic. Not this time. And I'm just going to ask you, I'm not going to go, what do you conclude that there are no protesters 9 days before an election like this? We'll see. We'll talk about it. This hour, we have two very important guests, General Jack Keane and Michael Goodwin, standing by. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
We conducted targeted and precise strikes on military targets in Iran.
The IDF said it hit Iranian surface-to-air missile systems and missile production sites.
That is a little what happened over the weekend. It's hard to believe that wasn't the number one story. Israel, surgical strikes back at Iran, as once again, Joe Biden pushes to scale back the response to Iran's 180 missile barrage 3 weeks ago. Hostage talks are back on track for the first time in months, and this will play a big role in the election, perhaps.
Number two.
Can someone tell me why we are once again holding Kamala to a higher standard than her opponent? Too many people are willing to write off his childish, mean-spirited antics by saying, well, Trump's just being Trump.
That is Michelle Obama, who is very comfortable in her speech, very comfortable on stage, But man, the content was disturbing. 2024, Harris rolls out a series of surrogates and a message of fear, fear of a Trump win. Will this closing tactic work? We go inside the numbers.
Number one.
But this is the city where I was born and raised, and this is the town that taught me that Americans can do anything when they want to. So no matter our differences, when we work together, there is nothing that we cannot achieve.
And that is a more optimistic message from Donald Trump. Trump takes Manhattan as he rallies a raucous crowd of the world's most famous arena. We'll look at some of the most unique speaker lists in political history, one of which had never been booked, that idiot comedian who said some disparaging things about Puerto Ricans and Hispanics, which I understand the Trump camp is incensed about, but that was the jumping off point, for everyone to ignore 4 hours of speeches. The president talks for 78 minutes, and they're going to talk about some no-name comedian who erroneously was booked at a time in which he wanted to be more famous. So I guess he's getting what he wants today. The headline of the New York Times, irresponsibly, in my view, Trump at Garden, a closing carnival of grievances, misogyny, and racism. A guy that used to work there, Michael Goodwin, joins us now from the New York Post. Michael, first off, your thoughts and your takeaway from Madison Square Garden last night.
Good morning, Brian. I was there, and to be inside the arena during that, it was quite a spectacle, I have to say. Trump said several times during his speech, you know, something's happening. And I think that neatly sums up that there is this fever for a real break from the past of contemporary politics. And so when you match sort of what Kamala Harris is offering and Michelle Obama's grievances about race versus the movement there that has taken shape, and as you said, the different voices on that stage. I mean, Elon Musk, Tulsi Gabbard, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Hulk Hogan, right, Dana White. I mean, it's really quite a cultural mix as well as a political mix. And I agree, something is happening. Now, whether it's enough to go across the finish line, you know, we'll know soon enough. But I do think that Republican politics has been changed forever. I think there's no going back. It's almost impossible to imagine, you know, a George W. Bush, a Mitt Romney, a John McCain in this environment. This is a new political party that Donald Trump has created and is still recreating, and it's quite a movement. It's quite a big slice of America that it could take place in New York City. I mean, the streets were all lined with people.
Did you see any protesters? Reported.
I'm sorry?
Did you see any protesters?
I did not see any protesters.
No one I know did.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess they gave up for the day. I mean, the police were out there. There was lots of protection in case they showed up, but it was a remarkably smooth event. I mean, that comedian notwithstanding.
Did you see him?
Was not representative of the evening.
But what did you think? Did you hear him, or were you?
I actually did not hear him. No, I didn't hear some of the earlier speakers. But it was, I thought it was a raging success. And I think for the left, for the media left, to try to turn it into something else, I think misses the larger point. And it just reflects their own desire to find something. I mean, you know, who's got more grievances than Michelle Obama and Kamala Harris?
Did you hear that? Did you hear her over the weekend? I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I mean, is this woman just not getting out enough? Things have not been good enough for her? She's one of the most revered women in the country. Every time she's on stage, she's angry about something. So I don't know, you know, what's so bad in her life, but maybe she's angry that, you know, I don't know, Kamala Harris, who she barely knows, is trailing. It's not my fault. And the other thing that reminded me of, when I'm watching this comedian, and this comedian said some off-color comments, and they go off on it and say, that's what the whole thing was about, racism. It's the same people that brought you Lawfare. I'm going to sue. I'm going to tell you how bad he is. The American people watch his ratings go up. Anyone who saw that event, nobody was taking away a no-name comedian who thought he was funny and being crude, who alienated Hispanics who happened to watch that 4 minutes. Now, having said that, That doesn't overwhelm Dana White, RFK Jr., Hulk Hogan. You have a myriad of other great speakers like Tulsi Gabbard. I mean, Rudy Giuliani spoke as well. It's kind of interesting selection. I want you to hear a little of Trump for people who missed it on one of the most unique bookings ever, a previous speaker, RFK Jr. Cut four.
We're not going to let him go too crazy, Elon, with the oil and gas stuff. And, you know, because Robert F. Kennedy cares more about human beings and health and the environment than anybody. And he's going to be absolute. Having him is such a great honor. I've been friends of his for a long time. And I'm going to let him go wild on health. I'm going to let him go wild on the food. I'm going to let him go wild on medicines. The only thing I don't think I'm going to let him even get near is the liquid gold that we have under our feet.
So, I mean, that to me is like, I just got to get the best team together, right?
Yeah. No, and I do think, I mean, Elon Musk put on quite a show himself last night. I mean, he's totally in. I mean, Trump joked that Musk has the black MAGA hat that I guess he designed or something. He calls it dark MAGA. But there is this joyfulness about a lot of this, Brian, and I think that's something that, of course, the media will never acknowledge. And I think that is a contrast. Yes, Donald Trump is angry, and many of his supporters are angry at the politics of the left. But they don't hate America. They're not blaming America, the soul of America. That's what Michelle Obama is doing, and I think that's one of the big differences. She seems angry at the country. The Republicans are just angry at the Democratic politicians. Big difference there, and that's why I think there is a lot of exuberance and a lot of joy there last night. And I think if it carries over, if it really does reflect the spirit that of the Trump campaign, then I think November 5th could be a really big event.
I want you to hear a little from Elon Musk. Cut 18.
Vote early. This is important. We're going to be putting up a scorecard, okay? An early vote scorecard, state by state, county by county. What is the scorecard? Vote early. Vote now. Make the margin of victory so big that you know what can't happen. Massive, overwhelming sweep of every swing state, and even some of the states that aren't, people don't think are swing states. Massive, crushing victory. Get everyone, friends, family, people on the street, put the signs up, put the hat on.
So to have the most innovative person in the world, who is changing the world almost every day, whether it's robots, or they're implanting chips in brains, or going using SpaceX or Starlinks or Tesla. Whatever you think, they forced him to Trump. They're starting to sue him, starting to hit him with litigation, all because he bought Twitter and was outspoken about certain things. And so now all of a sudden they're going after him legally. They pushed him to Trump. And then he realized how much he had in common. And they have to be wondering, how did we lose this guy?
And he started talking about buying Twitter and then bought it. I thought it was an interesting story, interesting business story, really. But the fact that all this censorship regime that comes from Washington and floats down through big tech and the media, he has been the antidote to that single-handedly. And, you know, his call for this to be a big victory, I share that because I think that if Trump were to win by a significant margin, by a landslide even, in the Electoral College, I think it would send such a message to the country and to the world about where politics is going, what is the way forward in this complicated world that we live in. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be such a rebuke to the transgender ideology, that the indoctrination of schools, the high taxes, the lawfare, just the far left drift toward all these crazy policies, right, toward appeasement of our enemies. I think so many things are at stake in this election that a clear victory would be the best thing for the country and really for the world that looks to America to lead the way.
So the president also spent 3 hours with Joe Rogan on Friday, and it was available on Saturday, and it's got like 20 million downloads already. And the president just sat there and shot the breeze with a guy he has a lot in common with, even though there's a difference in age of about 20 years because of UFC, because of state, like, but the performance element, you know, being in business, and they have a lot of mutual fans, but they didn't really ever, they never really spoke before. And he didn't say, I'm endorsing him. They said, let's just have a conversation. And if him's able to do that, then give a 2-hour speech in Michigan and then come back the next day, I don't know, and do his Penn State appearance and Penn State speech, whatever he did. And then he's back on Sunday doing what he's doing. And then yet you have Kamala Harris, who thinks the line of attack is the president's exhausted. There's not a person out there who thinks he's exhausted. And what are you talking about? So I just think that there's an interesting thing going on. Look, I do. We're on traditional platforms. You're in the newspapers. I'm on radio and TV. But the podcasts are playing an interesting role in this. Slice of life with the candidates. Rather than 4 minutes, 3 hours. Let's get to know you. They'll play Andrew Schultz, that podcast. I know Kamala Harris has done a few podcasts. What do you think about this media landscape? Do you think this is for real?
Well, I do. But I don't think it's static. I think it will continue to change. I mean, you know, in the lexicon of the moment, podcasts are having a moment, right? This is their first big election where they have played this kind of a role and where a lot of voters are hearing the candidates directly. I think that is always what we're evolving to, Brian, is that the media sort of just becomes a way for the candidates to connect directly to the voters. When you see what the New York Times is doing, for example, they're stepping between the candidate and the voters and trying to interpret it in a way that fits their agenda. Whereas I think the podcast, you know, especially the unedited ones, it's a direct stream from the candidate to the voter with the host asking questions. But I just wanted to make another point, Brian, about the Joe Rogan situation, for example. I think Donald Trump is a changing man. And I think it may go back to the assassination attempt. But it just strikes me that, again, last night, to have those people on stage and then for him to talk about those people in his own speech, Elon Musk, Kennedy, Tulsi, whatever, I think it shows that he's now willing to share this. He wants a bigger tent. He wants more people to come in. He'll give them the space. He'll give them the room to make their case. I mean, it's all within you know, his office, his candidacy, but it's a much more appealing and broader arrangement, it seems to me. Now, whether how far it goes, I don't know, but I do think that there is a kind of, this is like a Trump 2.0. There's a different Donald Trump here. He's not so, I think, in it just for self-aggrandizement. Not that he ever was. Not that that was only the ever thing. But I think there is much more of a sharing now of the limelight, of the load, of the responsibility, of the ideas, of the energy. I think it's a very healthy development.
Yeah, it's not. He knows it's not his family business anymore. It's going to be. Yeah. It's going to be spread out. I can't do it myself, and I wouldn't mind spanning out the responsibility. And have other people take the slings and arrows. It would be great not to play in a solo sport, play in a team sport, and that'll be more than ever.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah, no, you put it better. That's a great point, Michael. Michael Goodwin, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Brian.
All right, 1-866-408-7669. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
You've said that Trump has a special connection with the people
100%.
Of Pennsylvania. Why? What is it that you see that he appeals to in your state?
There's a difference between not understanding, but also acknowledging that it exists. And anybody spends time driving around and you can see the intensity. It's astonishing.
No, Senator John Fetterman, Democrat. Lewis, you're in Florida. Hey, Lewis.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for the opportunity. I've spoken to you before about the importance of the Hispanic vote. I'm American, of Puerto Rican ethnicity. And so the comment was horrendous. I mean, it's just so personally offensive. You know, it hurts you.
Tell me that idiot comedian from Madison Square Garden.
I mean, someone should have pulled his coat on this. You've got, 800,000 Puerto Ricans in Orlando. You know, you've got the Puerto Rican community that's voted Democratic, traditionally. Now you've got an element there, the Christian Puerto Rican community like myself, pulling for Trump. I'm super Trump. I understand he's a comedian. I understand he has license. I understand he spoke about Haitians, California, etc. But bad timing.
I hear you, Lewis. Lewis, you're 100% right. If it means anything, immediately they rebuked him on the Trump camp. And they can't control everyone. Who booked him, that's another question.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
There's hope, but it's really a difficult time to be too hopeful. Every family member that I've been continuing to talk with over the last year, they say every time that there's a potential ceasefire, they don't even read the headlines anymore because they're so disheartened that this time it would actually mean something different. There are some differences in what we're seeing in this potential ceasefire. So this would be a two-day ceasefire. It would release four Israeli hostages for some Palestinian prisoners who are being held in Israel. And the hope here is that because it's a short-term ceasefire, that maybe it would lead to a longer-term ceasefire. It's very different from the plan that President Biden laid out and how that was a long, drawn-out, three-plan ceasefire. This is a much more immediate, short-term goal.
So that is Alex Hogan. She's our foreign correspondent stationed in Israel, but she's in Tel Aviv and she's back home. So we talked to her on the set on Fox and Friends. But a person I talk to every single week on Fridays, it's what I look forward to most. It's a special treat for me. And it's all because the Yankees are in the World Series and he's going to be going to the game. General Jack Keane, welcome to the show in person. Great to see you.
Yeah, great to be here. It's always wonderful to be here in person. And you are quite accurate. It has a lot to do with the New York Yankees, and as we affectionately refer to as we're going to be in the cathedral tonight.
Back in the Bronx. I want to talk baseball, but also what Alex just said about this, talking about a ceasefire deal again, and it releases some hostages. Talks going on in Doha right now. And the question is, General, Sinwar's not there. He was never going to be there in person. Is this his brother running negotiations? Hania's dead? Is it one of the political versions, a political arm of Hamas? Who are they dealing with?
Well, they're dealing with Khalil al-Hayya and a committee. They've agreed to form a committee temporarily till they actually find a political chief and also a military chief. I know for a fact from my sources that the Mossad chief, Dave Barnea, offered to Hamas just recently, this weekend, free passage for their leaders out of Gaza, similar to what he had offered to Sinwar, and their response was much the same. Rejected the deal and said that the only way we'll accept anything in terms of a ceasefire is that all IDF forces leave Gaza completely and there's an end to the war. So that's a reflection of their position, which is an echo of Sinwar's position and his defiance for all of these months. So I think for our audience, we have to take these aspirational goals that we're hearing again about ceasefire being imminent and possible, et cetera, with a grain of salt. We have to have some patience about dealing with this. I know the administration hypes this quite a bit, and the reality has turned out, at least for the last 3 to 4 months, to be quite something different.
Right. And I don't want to spend too much time on the ceasefire. It's just one element because this is really expanded. But when they found on Sinwar, I did not know to the degree they found a laptop. When they, the report was, I read in the Daily, that when Sinwar was watching the news, the Israeli news, and the commentator was saying, you know, we are banging, one of the IDF spokesmen was saying, we are banging on his lair. We know exactly where he is. And they were. And he was hearing it. And he said, oh my goodness, they're going to kill me. So he grabbed his family and he grabbed what he could and he got out of there, but he left his laptop. And the laptop talked about, you saw all the correspondence with Iran's reaction to this deal, how this thing took place, the fake maneuvers and training they were doing to give the Israelis the sense that nothing really was going on when it was, the conversations with Hezbollah, and that when they find Sinwar dead on him was communication saying we got to keep the hostages alive because that's the only way we stay, make sure their health is okay. That's the only way we stay alive.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt about that. I mean, we understood that from the outset. The hostages, unprecedented, the amount of hostages, 250, was all about using them as leverage, and number two, making sure they got out alive. So that's the reality of it. And I thought what also was very revealing is how he really was counting on Iran and Hezbollah to support the attack. In other words, we all know what October the 7th looked like. You know, 1,000 Israeli killed, etc. And a very comprehensive, complicated attack by Hamas. But he wanted Hezbollah to fire ballistic missiles throughout Israel to take down cities and hurt the population. He wanted Iran to do the same thing. They did not do that. And he, in his mind, he was conducting the October 7th attack, hopefully supported by Hezbollah and Iran, to collapse Israel once and for all, to render the casualty so significant throughout Israel that the people would no longer want to live there and raise their children and their grandchildren, which is their ultimate goal, to destroy the state of Israel. Not physically, they know they can't do that, but break the will of the people to reside there. And he failed at that, but he has to be very frustrated that Hezbollah did start firing rockets and missiles into northern Israel, certainly on October the 8th, but that was not what he wanted. He wanted ballistic missiles, major cities, major casualties as a result of it, and he did not get it. That was the most revealing thing I got out of that iPad, it gives you a sense how fast he was moving if he left his iPad behind.
So, General, think about this. I know you do. Look what they got in return. They got the Gaza has been destroyed. Thousands of their fighters are dead. Their life is never going to be the same. They're going to have constant monitoring when Gaza got to rebuilt. There's no way the Israelis are ever going to pull out totally again, if at all. And then you have Hezbollah, their leadership decapitated. Thousands are hurt with the exploding pagers, and their tunnels have been exposed, along with the fact that they go all the way back to the UN enclaves, and the UN's coming forward and saying, yeah, we really couldn't do anything because they were essentially, they were like mobsters. They were stopping us from saying what's really going on here. So Hezbollah has been taking a beating, and Hamas has been almost, I would say, two-thirds of their fighters are dead.
Yeah. These are resilient organizations that we're dealing with, and Israel really has their hands full, and you're absolutely right. I mean, Hamas is never, ever going to rule Gaza again. The Israelis are not going to stand for that. So they have several thousand fighters that they're still dealing with, and they'll finish them off, or at least even reduce them so that their ability to conduct guerrilla warfare is diminished. Hezbollah is a tougher fight. You know, decapitated the leaders. They're destroying rockets and missiles somewhere in excess of 50%. They got four divisions in the south fighting the Hezbollah that are in the south and destroying the infrastructure. But they wanted Hezbollah to reduce their attacks on northern Israel. Fact is, they've increased them. On Saturday, 150 rockets and missiles. Sunday, 75. This is a resilient force that's got a huge capability, much, so our audience understands, much more significant capability than what Hamas has. This is a tough fight that Israel is in there. But, as you pointed out, they have seriously degraded this capability. And Iran, after this successful strike this weekend, they've taken down Iran's entire sophisticated air defense system and exposed everything that they value inside of Iran, national targets like nuclear enterprise, oil and gas structure, they were protecting that. The actual Tehran International Airport, that system is gone. And obviously they were able to take down ballistic missile production facilities. I think Israel has achieved a deterrence now over Iran, which was their objective. They didn't want Iran to come back robustly against them if they hit a national target like a nuclear facility. That was never a serious consideration, so our audience understands why. Because to damage that entire nuclear enterprise, which is 250 feet under the ground, in some cases thick walls. You need U.S. participation in that strike. So that was off the table. They could have taken out the oil infrastructure, but they knew Iran would have to respond robustly. So what have they done? They've taken out the air defense systems that are protecting it. So it is naked now, and the Iranian leadership knows how vulnerable they are. With every target they value, they no longer have a capability to protect those systems there. The reality of it.
So when people say it wasn't a significant strike, they're just wrong.
They're dead wrong. They don't understand the significance.
20
of
targets with 100 aircraft including F-35s or F-35s. But let me ask you something. When you say that they exposed them, did they also hit the location of the Grand Ayatollah to let them know they knew where they were? Did you hear that?
I don't know. I've not heard anything like that. I know that there's an air defense system that follows him around. And I don't know whether they got that air defense system or not. I suspect they did because they really wanted to clean all the air defenses. Right. So our audience understands. F-35s went into Syria first, then Iraq, because they had to take out their air defense system, which was the flight path that the fighters and bombers were going to follow to do the kinetic damage. Then they went into Iran, another wave, F-35s, and took out the entire air defense infrastructure that Russia gave them. All of it. Very, very significant. And remember now, we're going against the very system that can kill an aircraft. But because they have stealth aircraft, they can't see them. And they can destroy those batteries and those launchers. And that exposed the missile production facilities at two military bases. And they destroyed that. And no civilian casualties hitting at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. So I think the three things they wanted to accomplish, expose Iran to huge vulnerability as a result of the attack, much more than being reported in the media. Iran knows how exposed they are now. They are naked in front of another Israeli air attack. That's deterrence that they've achieved. Second thing, they were not going to force Iran to respond by taking down a national target like a nuclear facility or an oil production facility. That doesn't mean they won't do it in the future. I am convinced they will. Third, they didn't want to produce significant amount of civilian casualties, which would force Iran to respond. Right. So I think the strike was brilliant in terms of what they have achieved.
Great to know. Well, here's my worry, that the Russians say, we got this alliance now with you, and you need missile defense. I'm going to rush it in there. Just because you rush me drones, I don't know what they have in their storage, how quick they can do it. But if the Russians sign a mutual defense agreement with Iran, and they rush in a more sophisticated air defense within the next year or within the next month, does that worry you if you're Israel? Are you thinking that way if you're the U.S.?
Yeah, well, certainly the Iranians have been pressing them for more, and they haven't received it. It took them 9 years to get the S-300 in there. Russia has got their hands full dealing with Ukraine, particularly with Ukraine's long-range drone systems, where they're going all over Russia. So their own air defense systems are occupied. I don't know if they have any spares or some that they have in mothball that they can give to the Iranians. Certainly the Iranians are going to put as much pressure as they can. After all,
get help.
The Iranians are significantly helping Russia.
No kidding, yeah.
There's no doubt about that.
And the Russians are helping the Houthis with logistics to shut down the Red Sea.
And targeting. They're helping them target.
Got to leave some time on the other side. General, thanks so much. And we also have to talk a little Yankees before we go. So we'll take a short time out and come back with more General Jack Keane. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Expanding your knowledge base. It's The Brian Kilmeade Show. Radio that makes you think. This is The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Bases loaded, two gone. Trevino lifts a fly ball to center field. Tommy Edman is there, and the Dodgers lead this World Series 2-game set up.
I didn't really enjoy playing that for you, General Keane, but the game three is tonight. Redemption is upon us. Game 3, 4, and 5. So it'll be 3 Monday, and then 4. It'll be 4 tomorrow on Tuesday, and if necessary, 5. And we hope it's going to be necessary. No doubt about it. We're both pulling for the Yankees. What's been the difference so far?
Well, Yankee bats haven't showed up, and I think they should have won the first game. They should have kept Cole in the game longer. Cole's their ace, and he should decide if he's out of gas or not, and let him pitch into the seventh, eighth inning. That should have happened. And then the manager brings in a player, and Cortez, who hasn't pitched since September the 18th. He has a good record against the meat of their lineup, but hell, if he haven't pitched since September
and 18th, he's hurt,
you know, that is the most lame decision I've ever seen. The Yankees were two outs from a victory, and we lost the game. And who lost the game? Managers can't win game, Brian, but they can lose them. And Aaron Boone lost that game. That's a fact. The second game, Dodgers won fair and square. The Yankee bats did not show up, and the Yankee starter folded.
So how do you look at the best hitter I've seen, player, overall player you maybe have seen in a long time, 32-year-old Aaron Judge, who just came up 58 homers, almost hit a batting title, 142 RBIs. How do you explain what he's going through right now?
I think these are head cases more than anything else, you know, intimidation and pressure they put on themselves. A-Rod used to be a Yankee, and he was terrible in the playoffs until the 2009 playoff when he finally came to light, and he was decisive in helping to win the World Series. I'm hoping that Judge can find himself. I think that really is the issue here. I don't think the Yankees win the World Series without Aaron Judge exploding and being a dominant factor in it. That's the reality. But listen, so our audience understands, we've been here before. 1996, World Series, Braves and the Yankees. It had been 15 years since the Yankees were in a World Series. That's where we are today, 15 years. The Yankees lost the first two games at Yankee Stadium to the Braves. They went down to Atlanta, and Joe Torre said, "We got to win all of them, guys." And they went down there, and they were facing Tom Glavine, is the number three game pitcher, Hall of Fame pitcher. And our guy by the name of David Cohn went down there and beat him. And the Yankees won four straight and beat the Braves 4-2 after losing the first two games in Yankee Stadium. So we got history on our side. This is a different team. They got to find themselves. But believe me, they got the talent to recover here, and they certainly have the fans going to be there tonight supporting them.
And now that was famous as Wade Boggs hopped on a horse that security was using.
Yeah.
And it seemed like a longer drought than the 2009 to today because, it's, you know, from Steinbrenner being suspended, coming back, Gene Michael rebuilding the team, and then Joe Torre, how could you get rid of Buck Showalter? Torre takes over. Well, he's never really been a winner anywhere. And they just shocked the world with that comeback victory.
Yeah. 96, you know, put them on the path to those five World Series wins. It's just tremendous. And 1998 team was probably one of the best teams the Yankees ever had in its history.
Yeah. Right. And they would think so, too. I love what Fox has done. And they did it in football and they did it in baseball. I love seeing Jeter and A-Rod and Ortiz on the desk.
And they're all American League players. They played against Big Pappy, certainly, and the respect they have for each other is pretty obvious, you know. And, that's great stuff. Fox hired the right people to do it. I love it. And let's get it on tonight.
Right. And Jeter interviewing Aaron Judge before. And we have A-Rod on tomorrow, by the way, on Fox and Friends in studio with a live audience and Melania Trump. But A-Rod coming in. I to see Jeter talk to Judge. You almost forgot. The camera looked like it was eavesdropping, almost as if he's saying, "You can do it. Just relax."
Yeah. Right? That's what he's trying to tell him, you know. And Jeter was the steadiest player the Yankees have had probably since Joe DiMaggio and Mickey Mantle. And, Jeter's a base hitter, not a home run hitter. But his consistency all season and his consistency in the playoffs was all the same. He was hitting over 300.
Right.
He was the steadiest guy. He never went into these slumps like other people do, and then they had these hitting streaks. He was just a steady Eddie.
All right, General Jack Keane, that was your strategy for baseball, just as insightful as your one for the military. Thanks so much, General, and good luck in game three tonight. Go
Brian
Kilmeade.
Thank you.
News Radio Studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here, coming to you from Midtown Manhattan, where they're still cleaning up after that major. I'm not saying it's a mess or anything got damaged, But when you put 20,000 on the inside and another at least 10,000 on the outside of Madison Square Garden and the Knicks and Rangers and Billy Joel is not playing, that's a big story. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. Also in Midtown Manhattan, you got just four blocks away, the Roosevelt Hotel, where you have basically illegal immigrants everywhere. And six blocks from here on 42nd Street, you got this lethal gang, teenagers, harassing people. So this is a huge issue. It's become the number one issues of this campaign. And we'll discuss a lot of that this hour. We have two great guests. Standing by right now is Eli Lake. And at the bottom of the hour, we talk a little baseball with Jack Curry, studio analyst on the Yes Network, four-time New York Times bestseller. But if you want insight on this World Series, which got $15 million in Game 1 and $13 million in Game 2, two records that date back to 2007, you know that the American people are interested. But let's bring on Eli Lake, columnist for the Free Press and host of the Reeducation podcast. Eli, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian. It's great to be here.
Eli, how much you've been able to check out this election? How much you've been focusing on it?
I mean, I think we all are. We are all focused on it. I mean, I'm writing about it. I've been following it. My podcast, which is on the Honestly feed until the election. I've got an episode coming out on Saturday, which is about what I call Trump's superpower. So we have been focused. I think if you're in journalism, you have to look at this. This is an historic election. It's a big deal.
Yeah, it is a big deal. And to see what happened last night, what is your take on the Madison Square Garden event?
Well, I think that
everything from Hulk Hogan to...
I think on the one hand, it is impressive to have this diverse group of kind of cultural icons from different elements of our society, whether it's Hogan or Tulsi Gabbard or RFK Jr., all under, you know, at one stadium in, you know, the capital of the free world, if you will, New York City. It was in that respect a big success, although, you know, whoever was in charge of vetting the speakers who allowed this Tony Hinchcliffe guy, you know, should be fired, because that was, it was playing into a fake narrative that, you know, MSNBC is running literally like live feed of the rally. And I think their headline was like referencing, you know, the American Nazi Party rallies in the late 30s. It's like, you know, why are you giving your opposition, you know, why are you giving them ammunition? That joke was inappropriate. The Trump campaign immediately said, that's not what we think. Other Republicans kind of distanced themselves. I don't think it's going to necessarily be a big story, but imagine if you hadn't given them that ammo, then the entire thing would be about like, wow, you know, the most important industrialist since Edison, Elon Musk, is here telling people to vote for Trump along with a lot of other people. I've never, you know, this is the new Republican Party. This is a huge thing. And I think most Americans can look at that and say, what does this have to do with Adolf Hitler? But then you get this one guy who tells a joke that is, you know, not really appropriate. And I don't think it was reflecting the Trump campaign, but that's my only critique.
Yeah. And they're going to blow one thing out of proportion. You got to play the perfect game. Don't complain about it. Some things that stuck out. Number one, Oprah has lost two disciples now. He saw Dr. Oz as a contributor, gave her this great show, runs for 15, 20 years. And he's like, I'm a Republican. So she distanced himself. And then I look on the stage and there's Dr. Phil, another one very tight with Oprah. They're best friends and want nothing to do with that left wing philosophy. And she's on stage. Then you got Dana White. You got Hulk Hogan. You got Tulsi Gabbard, as you mentioned. And I think Elon Musk is the most intriguing because not only is he there, but he wants to fix things. And he's got this history of being successful. And not only is an innovator, but an organizer.
I mean, Elon Musk, until, 3 years ago, he was, you know, the ideal American liberal success story. He gave to Democrats. We assumed he was a Democrat. He had, you know, made his money in Tesla and SpaceX and I think eBay. You know, this is somebody who you know, was living the Silicon Valley dream, and most of that money and most of those people were Democrats, and they had the same values. And I think having, I mean, I'm not an expert on Elon Musk. I've only met him once. But I will say this. I've been watching his interviews, and he has opened up about, he has, I think, a teenager, adult, trans son.
Yes.
And he talks about that being this radical ideology which captured him. He's saying, I bought into this. They were telling him, like, you know, what do you want to, you want your own child to commit suicide when you have to go along with this, that kind of thing. And I think now that he's seen through it, he's furious. Like you find a lot of times when people learn that it's one thing, like, I don't want to say a bad word on your show. I'll say BS, okay? I think Americans are really tolerant of BS. BS is everywhere. It's in advertising. But when you uncover a lie from people who present themselves as authorities, as, you know, defending the guardrails of respectable speech, et cetera, when you find out that this is like an ideology or this is a big thing that they've been telling you is true and it's a lie, that radicalizes people. And I think we are watching a radicalized Elon Musk in that respect. And it's the trans ideology that did it, which is the big silent issue, I think, in this election, which is like, you know, we're talking about jobs, of course, we're talking about immigration. But the big thing under the surface is mm-hmm. that there were a bunch of elites that told us men could get pregnant and that stopped referring to women and said they were, you know, bodies with ovaries or whatever it was. And I think that there's just millions of Americans that's saying, that's just not true. Stop lying to us.
Eli, I think it's even bigger. You ready?
Yeah.
I think it all goes back to, let's say, if Donald Trump gets elected, the only reason he got elected is because of Russia. So for 2.5 years, no matter what Trump did good, or let's say he had bad policy, good, but no matter what happened, it went back to Russia. I'm meeting with Kim Jong-un, back to Russia. Don Jr. Right. had a meeting. So after 2.5 years and millions of dollars and destroying any U.S.-Russia relationship, and I know Vladimir Putin is evil. I'm under no illusions about that. But still, there's a lot of evil people we have relationship with. It blows up that whole relationship, and literally they were happy, and then after a while they realize this is detrimental. And then you have a situation with the pandemic, and they tell us to wear a mask. Masks don't work. Masks do work. You get a vaccine or you're vilified. You better do this. You better stay home. You better stay away. You better wash your clothes. You better hose down your groceries. And then never admitting they were wrong when all this stuff ends up being wrong. And then they lied to us how it happened. Then we have an election leading up to that. We have the laptop. Individually, those are significant things. But it's growing. Each time they keep telling us massive lies. And they want us to grow. Yeah. And then
you're really onto something, Brian, because – what are those – all those things, those are disparate examples, but what do they have in common? What they have in common is that the people who forwarded the lie were the guardians of objective reality. And what I mean by that is the Russiagate stuff wasn't relegated to Facebook commenters. It wasn't relegated to your crazy uncle at Thanksgiving. This was coming from the editorial pages of the Washington Post and the New York Times and the Atlantic Monthly. And that right there is the key point. The COVID stuff, that was coming from Dr. Anthony Fauci. It was coming from the CDC. This was coming from all of 60 Minutes. This was coming from the institutions that Americans had trusted for generations
right.
to give it to them straight. And when they didn't get it straight, it, I think, had a radicalizing effect, not on a few, right. but on millions. And that's why what we're seeing right now, this election, I think, is really about that. I think you really nailed it there.
And I want to grow it because after that, we find out since Elon Musk bought Twitter, and we know it's much bigger than Facebook, we find out behind the scenes they were manipulating what we learned about the pandemic, what we knew about the election, what we learned about Donald Trump, what stories were trumpeted up and ones were tamped down. And then we find out about the reality of social media 2.5 years in. I think that's also part of the metamorphosis of Elon Musk. He's like, wait a second. We were being manipulated by these social media networks who were in bed with our intelligence apparatus and the Democratic Party. Much of the time, Trump was still president. So who was actually in charge? It should have been Trump manipulating the social media. And then you go, well, there's a president trying to destroy the narrative. And so Trump is out. January 6th is an abomination. I'll never make excuses for that. But then when Trump is going to run again, they start indicting him time after time. And we see the folly of this ridiculous New York case. And then we see the conviction, despite there was no legitimate cause. And they try to bankrupt him and make $500 million from him. And the documents case, bad move taking him. But to raid his house, all this stuff, then people start going, wait a second, maybe this guy is not perfect, but he's not what they say he is. And maybe what he was trying to do, the communication wasn't perfect, but his objective was pure. And maybe he is not the second coming. And maybe I'm going to stop listening to you from now on. And that's what we have. I don't know what this is going to happen in the election, but if it ends up being a blowout for Trump, this is going to be the biggest reconfiguration of government and trust and media in our history.
I'm going to do – I think that there's one more point to add to that because I think you're right on all that. And that is, what's the closing message from Kamala Harris? Trump is a fascist.
Yep.
Well, I got news for you. You know what fascists do? They try to arrest and bankrupt their political opposition. You know what else fascists do? They try to pack the Supreme Court. You know what else they do? They say, all right, you know, I know we've been relying on the Electoral College since the beginning of the Republic, but we're going to eliminate that one too. So when you're talking about a party that on the one hand is promising fundamental changes to how we conduct elections and how we do business and for the first time prosecuting somebody. And like, it wasn't, you can say, all right, that's Alvin Bragg. It was, but it was the Democrats made it a part of their messaging. If you remember when Joe Biden was still running, and that's another part of it, he wins the primary and then they switch him out. But when he was running, he said, you know, I hear you're free on Wednesdays. I mean, kind of making light of, this real, like, total over-the-top, politicized, meritless prosecution that even honest liberals, people who hate Trump, even my friend David Frum, originally when this case was brought, he said, this is not the case to bring. This is not right. People who know the law, who know New York state law, lawyers, I'm not a lawyer, but those people, you can read them. They're on the record saying this isn't right. And they still went along to kind of do it. And you're like, wait a second, who's the fascist? You know, who's the fascist?
You forgot about the filibuster, too.
Yeah, the filibuster's another one, which is related to all this. And it's like, if you're going to make that case that he's the fascist, not only have we heard it for 8 years,
right,
and we have our memory that, like, you know, if Trump was really a dictator, why wouldn't he be taking advantage of the COVID lockdown conditions to consolidate power and so forth and really cancel the election, which he didn't do. If that's the case, and that, is it you're the ones who are doing all this stuff because you're trying to stop the fascists, I just find that, like, if you can just look at it objectively,
yeah,
a little bit critically, you're like, this does not wash. What are you talking about? And I just think that that's why I'm kind of amazed that that's the closing message. Although, you know, when you see this joke from Tony Kinkloff, I'm not saying the election is going to hinge on, you know, a comedian who spoke 4 hours or 5 hours before the president. I don't think that's the case, but it does provide, like, you know, the 15-second soundbite,
right,
that, you know, unfortunately gives ammunition to Trump's opponents in that respect.
Right. You could do that too, but then there's people that watch and we'll see what the ratings are, and then you listen to him on Joe Rogan and you go, is this really a lunatic that you're describing as? Is this guy too exhausted, mentally deranged? You don't go,
right,
for 4 hours, 3 hours with the number one podcast in this country and not show your dementia, if that's what you want Kamala Harris to say. But keep in mind, too, the thing that they don't understand is, how is he getting these crowds? How is he getting this type of publicity? Where is he getting this loyalty from? They still can't figure it out. And I want you to hear what Senator Fetterman, who seems to be free of any political inhibition since his stroke. Listen to this.
You've said that Trump has a special connection with the people
100%.
Of Pennsylvania. Why? What is it that you see that he appeals to in your state?
There's a difference between not understanding, but also acknowledging that it exists. And anybody spends time driving around and you can see the intensity. It's astonishing.
So they can't figure it out, or they can and don't want to admit it. But they can't shake him. And the anger that the Obamas bring to the stage, and Robert De Niro and people like that, it has really unmoored them.
Did you see the Michelle Obama speech?
Yes.
Over the weekend?
I couldn't listen to all of it. I had to shut it off.
I mean, her message was, if you're upset and you're angry, if you know a man, a husband, a brother, an uncle, and they're upset and they're frustrated, the message to them, she was speaking to the women, was to tell him, your anger will not affect my future and my right. And I'm like, is that a political message? You're basically telling people who support Kamala Harris that she has to, you know, shame people in, you should shame your family into voting for her.
Yes.
That doesn't seem like, that's not how we do it. You know what I mean? Like, I don't, how does that work?
I just
find that to be such a bizarre closing argument in an election. Where's the persuasion? Here's what I'm going to do for you and address your concerns. And she's incapable of giving, I mean, she mentions it. She says, yeah, the grocery prices are too high. Okay, that's a good start. But she's got to, like, where's her, like, actual plan that's going to work that doesn't involve fantasy land? Like, I'm going to eliminate the filibuster if I can't, pass a national ban on abortion or something. I mean, like, that to me is like, all right, you know, I just find it. It's the whole thing is anti-Trump, and it's replaying this campaign against him. And I just feel like, you know, it's way past due. And American people are not buying it.
Eli Lake, it's going to be a fascinating week. I didn't get a chance to talk to you about the Middle East, which is my bad. But you had some great points here. Well, hopefully I have you back later in the week.
I would love to.
All right.
And thanks for having me on.
And I loved you on the Free Press podcast. I was listening over the weekend with that intense debate on Israel and who the bad guys are in the Middle East.
Oh, great.
You didn't just win it. You won it with facts and history. And hopefully people listening had a pen handy. Eli Lake, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
You got him. And you can follow him at Eli Lake and find out everything he's doing, but you can find him on the Free Press. Don't move.
Covering this election year like no other, it's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, Jim, you're listening in Connecticut in WLAD. What's on your mind, Jim?
Hey, thanks for having me on, Brian. We had the pleasure of speaking a couple weeks ago about January 6th, and I know it's a hot topic. I just wanted to reiterate, because although you had said, well, he offered the National Guard the day before, that's not what the issue turns on. The bottom line is he aimed a well-armed mob at the Capitol and failed to protect the United States in his name, and it was a depraved dereliction of duty.
Jim, are you still talking about January 6th? We already know what's going to happen. Do not try to inform us on that. What do you want to do about it? Whether you're going to vote for him or not, there's no new information to come out of that.
No, I don't know if I'm still on, because I know you get to other callers.
No, you're
quickly,
on. Go.
But it utterly disqualifies him, and I urge all
if in your mind, don't vote for him. But there's nothing new. They've been playing this up now for 4 years. 4 years. He's still got the nomination. They indicted him. They tried to take his wealth. He still was the number one in the primary. He destroyed Joe Biden. And now he's in a dead heat, if not surpassing the other opponent. You got at least 70 to 80 million people who looked at January 6th and...
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Cortez delivers. Freeman hits the ball to right field. She is gone! Gibby! Meet Freddy! Game one of the World Series! Bases loaded, two gone. Trevino. Lifts a fly ball to center field. Tommy Edman is there. And the Dodgers lead this World Series 2 games.
Yeah, they did. And both games were winnable. But that's the way it goes. When you're playing against the Dodgers, you got to play better defense in game one, or else they would have gotten out without the sack fly that tied it 2. And then in extra innings, it was over. Everyone's talking about taking out Gerrit Cole in game one. Just some of the storylines and why 15 million people watched game one and 13.5 watched game two. Baseball's got to be happy, but the Yankees aren't. They are in a must-win situation in game three tonight. Pregame starts at 7 on Fox at 8:08. And a guy that's been there every step of the way for as long as there's been a Yes Network, and they used to cover him when he was a print writer, Jack Curry, studio analyst and Yes Network anchor, 4-time New York Times bestseller. Jack, welcome back to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, Brian, it's good to speak with you, and I'm glad we got a chance to talk about a World Series that is right in front of us.
I know. Since 2009, I didn't have you on then, and that was my mistake. I thought I'd have a shot the next year, but it's been a little bit of a drought. First off, your takeaway from game one, the Yankees' approach. Were you out there? Yeah, right?
We covered it. I was in our studio at the Yes Network. I was not in L.A. And you just hinted at some of the storylines that we did cover. I thought that Gerrit Cole had more in the tank in that game. I know Boone removed him after 88 pitches. His fastball was starting to get hit. He gave up a couple of fastballs. But, Brian, I just believe that Gerrit Cole is an ace for a reason. So I thought that he had more left to give the Yankees in that game. And then we covered this on our post game. I liked Tim Hill as the lefty matchup over Nestor Cortez late in that game, simply because as good as Nestor has been, he hadn't pitched in over a month. I know why the Yankees did it. I know what they liked about the matchups, and that Tim Hill's not a swing and miss guy and a guy who lives in the bottom of the zone, and they were potentially worried about what the Dodgers hitters could do. But this was not a second guess. I was standing on the in the studio with John Flaherty and Michael Kay and Bob Lorenz, and we all said, wow, I thought he'd go to Hill here and not Nestor Cortez.
Well, okay, that's fine. And made two mistakes. And as people have said to me, is that, you know, managers can maybe they can't win a game, but they can definitely lose a game. And we'll see where it goes from here. So they come back 0-2. Not insurmountable. And now you have Ohtani, who might be playing hurt, wrist or shoulder. What do you hear about his health? What do they tell you, and what do you think is going on?
Dave Roberts has said he would be surprised if Ohtani doesn't play in Game 3. He has said it's a pain tolerance at this point. And remember, he's a DH, so he's up there to get hits. If he's compromised in any way, I think Roberts will have to make an adjustment. But, Brian, we're talking about perhaps the best hitter in the sport. So, okay, if it's pain tolerance and he's compromised a little bit, you still want his bat in the lineup. I will say this. I'm surprised, because when that first happened and he was walking off the field, in my mind, I thought we were looking at an athlete who might be done for the series. It looked that problematic for the Dodgers. But Roberts is saying he expects to have him in the lineup.
All right. So tonight, I mean, you know Aaron Judge personally, correct?
I've covered Aaron Judge since he was a rookie, yes.
So we've seen some of this. This reminds me when Aaron Judge was trying to break Maris's record. He really went cold for a while, and he hasn't had the most success in the postseason. But this is really concerning. I mean, the numbers are just nuts about his inability to hit. And in clutch situations, in non-clutch situations, what do you think's happening?
Yeah, he's coming off, perhaps, Brian, the greatest regular season that any right-handed batter ever had. And now you talk about the postseason, and you mentioned that the numbers are not anything what the Yankees would want to see.
How about six for 40 with 19 strikeouts in 11 games?
But Judge is an honest athlete, and I thought Judge said something very important the other day after Game 2. He said, I'm not letting the game come to me. And, Brian, I've covered so many athletes who say you can't let the game speed up. And I think that's part of what's happening with Judge. I'm also going to rely on Joe Girardi. He's working for us with Yes. He was Judge's first manager. The other night he did a breakdown, and he had Judge being late on fastballs and early on the breaking stuff. And when you get caught in between like that, no matter how great a hitter you are, you're not going to get the results that you need. I still think there's a very good series in Aaron Judge. He's got time to resurrect himself.
I hope so.
I think the Yankee Stadium fans are going to welcome him tonight. And I think if Judge can follow his own methods of letting the game come to him, not chasing as much. That's the other thing he's been doing, Brian. Our research guys at Yes are great. And his chase percentage, chasing pitches out of the strike zone, higher in the postseason than it is during the regular season. You get yourself in trouble when you chase the pitches they want you to chase.
Here's Aaron Judge.
You know, I definitely got to step up. I got to do my job. You know, guys around me are doing their job, getting on base, you know, and I'm failing them, you know, backing them up. So, yeah, we got to turn around Game 3. We know what's at stake, you know, so everybody's showing up. It doesn't matter what happened the night before. So, you know, we got to show up big time in Game 3 in the Bronx.
And when I said I hope so, I'm not saying as a Yankee fan, I like the Yankees. I always grew up a Met fan, but I've never been a hater of the other team. But when I say that, it's because he's one of the great people in sports. And so you want – nobody could have nonstop success. But if anybody could have success, you want a guy like that to be successful, who will give you the time of day when he doesn't have a good series. Look, I just told you the stats. Everybody else, he's captain of the team, but and the stakes. And he's reading and hearing how bad he's been. And he could easily blow off the press or have an attitude and make every question sound stupid. And we watch that with Barry Bonds and people like that all the time. And he doesn't do it. And I appreciate that. Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, it's tough when you are used to a level of excellence and then you have this kind of rut. And it's more than a rut. It's been a struggle for Aaron Judge. And when you talk about being a captain of a team and being a leader, I think this is what leaders do. Cortez, the other day, when he gave up the grand slam to Freddie Freeman, he answered questions for 12 minutes. Some guys might have done one round of questions and said, okay, I'm good. I already answered that. I watched Mariano Rivera do that after the 2001 World Series when the Yankees lost that. So it comes at you fast when you lose a game, but there right. is a responsibility to be able to answer questions, and I think we all appreciate that when that happens.
All right, so this Dodger team really plays really good defense. The one thing I think is that something that you credit the manager with or a system with? I mean, they do have a lot of free agents. They do grow their own players. I'm just amazed how fundamentally sound they are.
It's a great question, Brian. I think it starts with the manager. It's the entire organization. It's every individual player. Before this series started, I was talking with Michael Kay, our play-by-play guy, and you don't want to lose a game on a defensive hiccup or a base-running gaffe. And you just hit on it. When you have those kinds of things happen to the Yankees in Game 1 with Gleyber Torres not fielding a relay throw that came back in. So it's repetition, it's routine, and it's when you get to this level,
yeah.
making sure that you can make those fundamental plays, as you said.
All right, so let's preview tonight. What's the matchup?
Clark Schmidt against Walker Buehler. I think from a Yankee perspective, they got to get an early lead, Brian. If you get an early lead, you get those fans into the game, you get them starting to dream about making the Dodgers feel uncomfortable. They've already made the Dodgers feel uncomfortable in this series. As you noted, Game 1 was a very winnable game. Game 2, they had the bases loaded in the ninth inning, down a couple of runs. So I think the key is getting an early lead, and they need Schmidt to outpitch Buehler. And I think that's very much in Schmidt's DNA. He's a very confident kid. He's got great stuff. I would actually say after Gerrit Cole, he might have the best pure stuff on the Yankees. So I think that, and as you and I discussed, if Judge hits a ball into the seats, these Yankee fans are going to go bonkers, and it's almost going to feel as if everyone in the Yankees will say, okay, you got a series now.
And then Game 4 becomes as much pressure on the Dodgers as it does on the Yankees.
And the Dodgers, Brian, are pitching out of the bullpen in Game 4. They haven't even announced a starter. So when you're doing a bullpen game, you're relying on five or six guys to all be perfect, and I think that makes them susceptible.
I hear you. In terms of the crowd, Judge gets up at the plate. That gave you the numbers. We also know he had 58 homers over at 340, almost won the Triple Crown, 142 RBIs or whatever it is. Stunning, stunning numbers. Do they boo? Do they standing up? I mean, what do they do?
Absolutely not. I would be shocked if one Yankee fan booed Aaron Judge. I think they understand the circumstances, Brian. I think they understand what he has done for them. And I think there's going to be a passion and an enthusiasm to prop Judge up more than knock him back. So we'll see. We'll see early because Judge is going to bat in the first inning. But I think the fans are going to embrace him and try and help push him forward, not knock him back.
All right, go get him. Jack Curry, always appreciate your analyst. Analysis, and of course, you can check you out on Yes, right? What time do you hop on today?
Thanks a lot, Brian. Yeah, our pregame starts at 6:30, so check us out. I know you mentioned the Fox pregame, but we'll have coverage starting at 6:30.
Yeah, and then what about postgame?
Yeah, we come on right after the Fox guys, right after John Smoltz and Joe Davis finish. We'll do a lengthy postgame, probably 90 minutes, and we'll have all the angles covered.
I love it. Jack Curry, thanks so much, Jack. I'll talk to you again.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it.
All right. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. When we come back, I'm going to be able to get to the phones and also find out if you need to know more. We're going over a few things. Of course, the aftermath of the MSG event was historic. And then we have Kamala Harris just spoke, calling out Donald Trump. Tomorrow, she's going to have her closing statement. It's going to be at the Ellipse, same place where Donald Trump gave his remarks on January 6th. No doubt that's going to be the theme. Remember what he did last time. He'll do it again. Will that work? Joe Biden bailed out of that angle. It looks like Kamala Harris is holding on to it. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Want even more, Brian? Download the podcast at BrianKilmeadeShow.com. Every episode, exclusive interviews on demand. More of Kilmeade coming up. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
You didn't have a scar in your ear? You got anything on there?
I do.
What am I say? What do you got
so,
there?
Right over here.
That's a tiny little mark.
It zicked right there. Yeah.
It healed up pretty good.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah, it's little. It's not like some of the wrestlers, some of the UFC fighters.
No, you didn't get cauliflower ear.
No. It got me. It was sort of like a top shot.
Mm-hmm.
The point of the bullet was a little in the ass. But you see, the thing's taken off a little bit. But it makes me a tougher guy.
So he liked that. And by the way, that's one thing Joe Rogan said after he got shot. He goes, I just got to back this guy, because it's not so much that he got shot, that he got back up and was looking to fight like that. So did you listen at all, Allison?
I got to listen to the first like 25 minutes so far. I need to listen more.
I mean, a lot of the stuff you've heard, like some of his answers.
It is, but then he asks when he's, when it's in a more conversational environment like that, his answers, it just sounds more real. Not as if he ever doesn't sound real, but it's not as like political. We're on a show. We need to get the right answers in.
Well, he was asking him questions.
Yeah.
He was asking afterwards, why didn't you get into fighting? You think it'd be this big? He's going to do you think your podcast would be this big if you weren't on USA? And he said, I think it would be, because he was a stand-up comedian before. And so it's very rare. I would love to see Trump host a show.
That would be interesting.
Be very interesting to see him do that.
Like conversational Trump. What I thought was just the first part of it, when I think Joe Rogan asked, like, was it just sort of like very impactful, the moment? And he did talk about it, like when they walked into the White House, how he was sort of struck by it.
Right.
And he had to take a step back, and eventually it became normal. But I haven't heard him say that before.
And he broke his head. All right, you got off to doing your weave again.
Yeah.
You
got
to
go back. I know.
But it's crazy. Let's find out if there's more to know.
More to know. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen is the most recommended memory support brand by pharmacists.
Here we go. Luke Combs and Eric Church doing a great thing. They led a star-studded concert for Carolina on Saturday. It raised $24.5 million for relief efforts in Carolina. They will need it. Attended by 82,000 concertgoers. The event's featured performances from James Taylor, Keith Urban, Sheryl Crow, Billy Strings, Bailey Zimmerman, Scotty McCreery, Chase Rice, the Avett Brothers, Parmalee, as well as surprise appearances by Nicole Kidman and Randy Travis. I don't know if they sang, but that's a star-studded lineup. 82,000 people?
That's great, and 24.5 million, so hopefully it gets to the right place.
Hosted by Marty Smith and Barstool Sports Caleb Presley, the benefit show, organized by Combs and Church in less than a month, took place at the Bank of America Stadium in Charlotte, North Carolina. All right, good news. Next, best Halloween candy, the top five ever Halloween. The most overrated holiday ever. I'm not into Halloween.
You're such a curmudgeon.
Five is Starburst. Four is M&M's. Three is Twix. Two is Snickers bars. And number one is Reese's. And I've said this. If there was a candy that I consistently liked from the time I remember having a choice, it was that. But I never understood why they held it to just two per package.
Oh, the Reese's. You do like your peanut butter.
I'm pro peanut butter.
And you can get them in packs of six now, Brian.
You can get them in packs of six?
King size.
Well, that's bigger, not really. Yes. I shouldn't be having that.
There's a Hershey store right at the corner of our block, and you can get the giant Reese's peanut butter cups. It's like one mega one.
And let me tell you, has this been explored? Like, is Starburst, what is Starburst? Is it a candy? Is it like a taffy? Because like Razzles. You ever have a Razzle?
A long time ago.
Right. Razzles, like you eat them and you think it's gum, but then it's gone.
I mean, Starburst is candy. It's not gum, but it's a little chewy. Not healthy for you, but, you know, delicious.
Next, New Zealand airport caps goodbye hugs to 3 minutes to avoid traffic. I love this. The early reactions were mostly negative, with some describing the move as inhumane. One person says the pushback is softening as the story has gone viral in world media. You get 3 minutes to hug in America, they don't even want you to stop. Just come to slow roll and push your kid out. I'm serious. That's That's in America. Another note of that, in the United Kingdom, some airports levy large fines for stopping even briefly in the drop-off area. Dundee Airport has no plans to strictly enforce the time limit, but deploying a hug police. They say, although they joked about deploying a hug police with their minute timers. Have you heard of this? This is a fantastic story ever.
I did see it. I mean, but a three-minute hug, I mean, that's a long embrace.
That means you hug, talk.
Right? Yeah, 3 minutes straight at
right.
hugging.
Yeah,
awkward,
I mean, you don't just
even
hug.
Even with, like, your spouse.
Because it's almost like a hold. Like, after a while, I was like, wait a second, are they wrestling?
So would you be like, if they tried to stop you from hugging that long, this isn't a hug, it's a hold, you're not correct.
Right. I mean, what you got to do is hug, release, start again. Hug, release,
restart
start again.
Restart the timer.
Right. Can we work on Eric? Can we work on this tomorrow? Can you get a hug expert?
I mean, 3 minutes is egregious, but imagine having to be the guy to have to get between two people embracing.
Break it up, guys. We're married. Enough. We know. Next, a woman taking pictures in Australia's Hunter Valley region dropped her phone and then slipped into a rock crevice where she stuck upside down. An emergency responder tried to free her. She found herself literally between a rock and a hard place, caught between two boulders in roughly a 10-foot. I've seen this video. By the time the emergency responders arrived, she was hanging by her feet for over an hour. It took 7 hours to rescue her. Her name is Matilda, as you would think, Campbell, 23 years old. So she's okay. I mean, I feel terrible.
Put the power of over 100 meteorologists and the worldwide resources of Fox in your hands with the Fox Weather Podcast. Precise, personal, powerful. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.